Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Marinez is our guest this hour. David has yet another superb book, this one on Barack Obama, The Story. The volume, he says, is not a traditional biography. It begins long before Obama was born and ends before he entered politics. David will be writing another book, if not a couple books, on Barack Obama. The research for this particular book took David around the world, well over 50,000 miles to many places that he said he might never have gone to otherwise. He traced Obama's roots in Kenya. He went to Indonesia. He was in Hawaii, Kansas, Chicago. David is an associate editor at the Washington Post. He has written many books, including bestsellers on Bill Clinton, Vince Lombardi, Vietnam, the 1960 Rome Olympics, and he is our guest this hour. David's latest book is Barack Obama, The Story. Hello, David.
Kathleen, great to be with you again.
Oh, my gosh, did you work on this book? You just went to so many far-flung places.
Sometimes people call it exhaustive, and that makes me tired. But it was mostly a wonderful journey for me to go to those places, many of which I would never have gone otherwise.
Yeah. And when you read the book, it is, and I think this about him, every day I see this president, and it struck you, it must still strike you, but you're in Indonesia, and you see a picture of the president and the first lady smiling on the night that he got the Democratic nomination for president. You're in a classroom,
right,
and you say how utterly improbable it was that Barry had made his way to that scene. I mean, it is just utterly improbable, isn't it, David?
Well, you know, it's so obvious and apparent that sometimes I would forget it, and that was one of those moments when the obvious washed over me in a sort of more powerful way, you know, walking the narrow alleyways of that neighborhood in South Jakarta, Mentang Dalam, and, you know, thinking that this young boy was not, in the protective Western bubble of an international school, but had to sort of sink or swim there, learning the language and playing with the neighborhood kids and going to the neighborhood school. His name then was Barry Santoro for 3 years. He took the last name of his stepfather, Lolo Santoro. And it was then, when I was there, that thinking about and seeing that picture on the wall, what an improbable journey it was from Lolo Santoro to President Obama.
You spend a good portion of the book on his ancestors, his parents, his grandparents, and his great-grandparents. There is kind of a theme that runs through many of them, and pick whoever you particularly want to talk about. But there's this very smart, they're all readers, it appears to me. They're slightly unorthodox. They get married early, or they get pregnant early. But there's a kind of a tolerance in places that you wouldn't expect that there would be a lot of tolerance, places like Kansas.
His grandparents both came from Kansas, Stanley Dunham and Madeline Payne Dunham. One of the remarkable things about Stan Dunham, who is a very colorful character, to say the least, not exactly a role model for his grandson, although he did certainly love him and embraced him in an era when that wasn't always a popular thing to do with a biracial kid. But Stan Dunham, when he was a boy, was essentially orphaned when his mother committed suicide, and he went to live with his grandparents. And also at that house was his great-grandfather, a guy named Christopher Columbus Clark. And so through Stan Dunham's own life, you can see someone. Christopher Columbus Clark fought in the Civil War for the North with the Missouri Militia. So through this one person's life, it goes from the Civil War to the first African-American president more than 150 years later. Quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. And he meets, there's this pattern of the women marrying very young or getting pregnant very young.
Yeah, his grandmother, Madeline Payne, eloped when she was in high school.
Wow.
That, too, was sort of a pattern in the family that happened later with Madeline marrying a guy that her parents didn't really like or want her to marry. They called her father called Stan Dunham sort of a slick-haired wop, not a PC term, but that's the way he was presented in that era. Then generation later, their daughter, Stanley Ann Dunham, marries the African Barack Obama Jr.
And what is it? You talk about the past not being dead and how the past informs who we are in some ways. How do you see that distant past from Barack Obama informing his life, the stories that stayed with him, the character traits?
Well, I think you see some of all of his ancestors in Barack Obama. That's not to say that he isn't also his own creation, and the second half of my book is really about how he remade himself. But from that white grandfather, Stanley Dunham, it's mostly physical characteristics. The long face and the big ears and the chin are Stan Dunham's. From his father, he got his deep voice and inordinate self-confidence. From his grandmother, his white grandmother, Madeline Dunham, sort of the pragmatic side of him you can see very clearly. She was sort of a cool character herself and not particularly emotional, but very pragmatic. And from his mother, Stanley Ann Dunham, he's sort of, I think she inculcated in him her conscience and her sense of trying to look at the world through other people's eyes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the moment. The story of his father is just, his father was such a jerk. But the story of his father is just amazing.
Yeah, you know, I write in the book and think it's true that President Obama was lucky he never lived with his father.
Mm.
In his memoir, Obama makes it sound as though the family was together for 2 years and then the father left to go off to Harvard graduate school. That's the story his mother told him, you know, and it's understandable of her trying to be protective of that and from protect him from the harsh realities of life. But in fact, they did get married. They never really were together. And that's probably for the best. He was not only an alcoholic, but also physically abusive. And
right.
In Nairobi, I found and spent a long day interviewing Barack Obama Sr.'s third wife, who was also an American, Ruth Baker Endesanjo. And she told me horrific stories about physical abuse and really threatening her life. So.
Let's go to the part of the book, and I love the historical context of Nikita Khrushchev around that time in the Cold War happening, but their meeting at, of all places, a Russian class at the University
of
Hawaii.
Yeah, just a chance meeting.
Really?
Barack Obama Sr. came to Hawaii as part of the first wave of Kenyan students being educated in the United States, really in preparation for that country's independence, which would come a few years later. And he ended up there by chance because he'd read an article in the Saturday Evening Post extolling sort of the virtues of the University of Hawaii with its many-shaded beauty queens, which attracted him because all he'd read about the United States was about the civil rights era and the difficulties of racism and so on. And so Hawaii sounded like a different sort of place. That's why he got there. Stanley Ann Dunham, you know, her father was constantly searching and going further west from the Kansas roots to Oklahoma and Texas and California and Washington State and finally ended up in Hawaii. And she was only 17 years old when she enrolled as a freshman there, and that's where she met sort of this charismatic, brilliant Kenyan, not knowing how troubled he was in other ways.
I guess he had quite a voice, didn't he?
Yeah, it was compared sort of, it was a basso profundo. Several people compared it to sort of a Paul Robeson type of voice. And when he spoke, everybody in the room knew it.
Mm-hmm. And he had his life pretty much planned out. What was he doing here? What was his ultimate goal?
Well, he wanted to be trained to be an economist in the Kenyan administration when they got independence. That was his intention, and he was mentored by two people. One was an evangelical Christian missionary from the United States named Betty Mooney, who had hired him in Nairobi to help her in her literacy program. She was spreading the gospel and literacy at the same time. You know, for those people who sort of try to portray Obama as a closet Muslim. In fact, the story in Kenya is that every step along the way, the rise of the Obamas was helped along by evangelical Christians, and Muslims had nothing to do with it. He was also sponsored by a fellow Luo tribesman, that's the tribe he came from in western Kenya, named Tamamboya, who really helped organize and sponsored that wave of Kenyans to come to the U.S. for training.
Hmm.
So that was his intention.
Is it fair to say, David, that Barack pretty much put the president put his father at somewhere in the deep recesses of his mind until he got the phone call that he had died, or was his father omnipresent?
Well, I think the vacuum of his father was always part of his thinking. You know, he didn't have a father, so it's hard to grow up and not think about that, and he certainly did. And he was told stories about his father by his grandparents and his mother, which put the father in the best possible light. So he had a lot of mythology in his mind about who his father was, but at the same time was angry that his father wasn't around. And so when he finally got that call that his father was dead, he sort of dramatizes that a bit more in his memoir than I could find to be evident in his life. He didn't talk about it to any of his friends at that period much at all. And the book, Dreams for My Father, accentuates his father in a way that somewhat diminishes his mother, who was the true influence in his life.
Mm-hmm. I want to hear more about your trip in Kenya, because you met with his step-grandmother, and there's a story in itself, and and also with one of his father's sisters.
Well, in his memoir, President Obama writes about his step-grandmother, Granny Sarah, or Mama Sarah, and makes her sort of a central character in the Obama clan story. So I went out to see her, to visit her, in the village of Nyangoma Kogelo, out in the Nyanza province. And I was like going to see the Queen Mother, really. I mean, you know, the whole compound now, you can see the satellite dishes from a mile away.
Oh, my gosh.
And there were gates surrounding the whole compound. And there were trinket souvenir salesmen outside of the gate. And inside, some very officious young men sort of protecting her, quote unquote. And so when I got there, I'd already arranged for the interview, but it was pretty difficult going. And one of the young men who was sort of vetting me asked a few questions about my past, and then said, David, Mr. David, is that Christian or Jew? Which was disconcerting, obviously, and my response was both, because it is and I am. So it sort of deteriorated somewhat from there in that visit. Although it was fascinating, there were a lot of people coming to that compound, including a young couple from Iowa who were a black African-American man and a white wife, and they had a biracial kid, and they wanted him to sort of be blessed by Mama Sarah, sort of that kind of place. But the reality is that she's not a fraud. I mean, she was his step-grandmother, but she's not nearly as important as one might assume, and many of her stories have found to be unreliable, whereas the real relatives, the blood relatives, live in relative anonymity about 50 miles away in the towns of Kanyadiyang and Oyugis. So that's where I found Barack Obama Sr.'s sister. She and he had the same father and mother, which was not all that common. There was because of the polygamy of the Luo tribe. And so she, you know, she told me, and she and her children told me many other stories. And they, you know, they lived in mud huts with thatch roofs, and nobody was going to visit them. They weren't part of the royalty.
David Marinus, our guest this hour. His book is Barack Obama, The Story. Here's our phone number. If you'd like to join us, we would be very happy to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can also leave messages on the Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Marin is our guest. His book is Barack Obama, The Story. Feel free to join our conversation anywhere along the line at 800-486-8655. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott. Go right ahead.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to say, Mr. Moranis, I do admire your work, and I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
And what I'd like to ask you about is I read a review of your book where it mentioned that when Barack Obama was in high school, he hung around with a group of, I think, probably guys who referred to themselves by the Hawaiian word for marijuana smokers.
Yeah,
and I guess what I'd like to find out from you is, how does that square with a president who names an attorney general who is now engaged in a war on medical marijuana? And a friend of mine who still lives in California and, by the way, does not smoke marijuana anymore, is just livid. He says, look, this is the one part of our economy that's working out here. What's this guy doing?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. Yes, in high school, Barry Obama, as he was called then, did two things more than anything else. Which one was play basketball, and the other was hang out with his buddies, who called themselves the Chum Gang. They weren't a gang in any violent sense, but they did like to smoke marijuana. And unlike President Clinton, Barack Obama never claimed that he didn't inhale. Matter of fact, he said that was the point. And, you know, it was only when I wrote about the details of that I realized how many people were out there on Twitter and Facebook and so on who were outraged by what they saw as the contradiction between his high school days and his policies on marijuana. I don't really have a profound answer for you on that, but I understand that people might think there's some contradiction there, although obviously what one does in high school and what one feels comfortable with as a politician in American life are two different things. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more of probably a pragmatic matter of Obama as opposed to what he might really believe in his heart in terms of marijuana enforcement.
Thank you, Scott, for the call. The number is 800-486-8655. You start the book with being in Hawaii and finding this little marker. Can you talk about that story?
Well, Barry Obama in high school went to the Punahou School, which is the elite school in all of Hawaii, a very fine academic prep school in Honolulu. And when I was there doing many interviews, one of his classmates took me on a sort of a tour of the grounds of the campus. And not far from the Dole cafeteria on the sidewalk where they'd laid some new cement in about 1978 when Barry Obama was a student there, etched into the cement is the word Obama. And, sort of was synonymous for decades, people, other kids and students walking over it, and now, of course, it has a further resonance. And I write in the introduction, that could have been his one lasting mark on the world.
It wasn't. I know you spent, it was scheduled to be a 45-minute interview with the president, and it wound up to be much longer. Were you teaching him things, and if so, what, David, that he didn't know about his life?
Well, I imagine that that's true to some extent. It was the last interview I did, and I didn't want to go in there until I knew as much or more about his family history as he did. And so, in any interview of that sort, the more you know, the more likely you are to get more information from the person you're interviewing. For Wisconsin listeners, I should say that the meeting began with a Packers-Bears discussion.
No, did it really?
Because he's a Bears fan, and
yeah.
I'm a Packers fan. And, and so the way it started, 2 years ago they played in the NFC Championship game, and Obama had announced that if the Bears won, he was going to the Super Bowl. and they lost. And Charles Woodson, the great Packer, said after the game in the dressing room, you know, President Obama won't come see us play in the Super Bowl, so we'll go see him at his house, meaning they'll win the Super Bowl and get the visit. So when I walked in the Oval Office, my first words were, Mr. President, Charles Woodson got here before me, but I'm glad we both finally made it. And he said, man, those Packers were rough on me. And I said, well, deservedly so, you're a Bears fan. And he said, yeah, but every time I come to Wisconsin, they give me another share of Packer stock. And he comes a lot because it's a swing state. So that's where the meeting began. And then I had given him a copy of the introduction to my book because I wanted him to understand the depth of what I had done and some of my conclusions. And in the book, I point out differences between at various points of what I'd found and what he'd written in his memoir. They're two very different genres, and I tried to put it all in context. But he read that and said, David, I like your introduction, but you call my book fiction, which I did not. I called it literature.
Mm-hmm.
And then we spent about a half an hour going over some of those points. Whether it was family mythology that he passed along unwittingly or sort of purposely made composite characters and compressed the chronology some. We discussed those points, and in almost every instance he acknowledged that I probably got it right. So it wasn't a major point of contention. There was some dispute over the composite he wrote about that he made out of his New York girlfriend and what I'd actually found her. So, of course, he was curious about that and wanted to know where she was and how she was doing, and that probably extended the interview some as well. When I interviewed President Clinton during the 1992 campaign, if he didn't like, or if he was a little bit leery of where I was going with my questioning, he could filibuster for an hour and never take a breath, and I couldn't get in a second question. And President Obama was not like that. He was slightly defensive a couple of times, but mostly very straightforward and answered my question.
And I found, and maybe I'm not supposed to, I read a good chunk of the book, but I really did find the former girlfriend Genevieve piece pretty fascinating, David. And then I was trying to think after I read it, why am I finding this so interesting? And it was partially because her diary really gave us, I think, a pretty right-on idea of his aloofness, of his being engaged and smart. But she saw something in him that many people see in him now.
Yeah, that's why I used so much of it, because, you know, there's an assumption, well, if you got an old girlfriend's diary, it's going to be embarrassing and salacious and all of that. And I found her to be perceptive.
Yeah.
And really, that's such an important part of my book, his sort of search for his self-identity. And she saw several things. She saw what she called the veil between him and the rest of the world, that there was sort of I wouldn't use the word aloof, but a coolness and guardedness that she couldn't penetrate. And many people have found that in various degrees. She was not a scorned lover type, so I didn't have to really worry about that. But the only thing that she was upset about when I conducted my many interviews with her was his portrayal of his New York girlfriend in his memoir makes her look like she's naive about matters of race when in fact she wasn't, and that she was more of a sort of a elite insider when she felt as much of an outsider as he was. So she felt a little bit betrayed by that aspect, which in fact, when I interviewed him, he said, well, that was a composite. It wasn't really only her. It included some other girlfriends.
Hmm.
So, but yes, I think that she saw him sort of searching for his racial identity. She saw him sort of, that there was a part of him that she couldn't get to and she wasn't sure anybody could. But she also did say that she wasn't the right one for him in the end. And she wrote in her journal that there's a vivacious, strong, intelligent black woman waiting for him out there.
Did she have any regrets of not being able to go the distance and become first lady?
Oh, I'm sure, probably, although I think she would have been a disaster as a first lady. and I really like her quite a bit, so I didn't mean that as an insult. But,
right.
But she had some other she wasn't political, let's put it that way.
Okay. Colleen in Darlington, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering if his sister's still living. If so, are they close, and where does she live at?
Yeah, well, he has a few sisters. So the one I think you're referring to is Maya, who was his. They have the same mother. Maya was the product of Stanley Ann Dunham, the mother, and Lolo Satoro, the Indonesian, her second husband. And she is very much alive. She lives in Honolulu. She's a teacher. She teaches history and cultural history at a private school there. She is pretty close to the president. I would say that they have a strong relationship. She's 9 years younger. She spent most of her childhood living with the mother, whereas Barack spent most of his adolescence and teenagers living with his grandparents. So she was even closer to the mother than he was in some ways. And she's married to a Chinese Canadian, so the diversity of that family just keeps growing in different ways.
It sure does. We need to talk about Chicago for a while, how he decides that he's going to go to Chicago and how effective he is as a community organizer. I was impressed by how he moved the length of the South Side and really knew the neighborhoods and was pretty fearless in going up to people he didn't know and having substantial conversations and gaining their respect. But let's start with why he went to the South Side of Chicago to become a community organizer, David.
Well, he had graduated from Columbia in 1983. He never really felt comfortable in New York City. He was there for 4 years total. And from the time he graduated, he'd read about the election of Harold Washington as the first African-American mayor of Chicago, and he wanted to go there. Chicago has always been kind of historically the pole star for Black America, and Obama was on this search towards home in the African-American community. He wasn't there yet, but Chicago represented something to him. So he kind of naively applied for a job in the Harold Washington administration. Not knowing that you don't do that in Chicago. It's who brung you, you know. He didn't have any sponsors, so he didn't get a job. But 2 years later, three people arrived in Chicago within 6 months of one another. The first was Oprah Winfrey. The second was Michael Jordan. And the third was Barack Obama. two became world famous immediately, and one who was completely anonymous during that period. He was hired as a community organizer on the South Side by an organization, the Developing Communities Project, that was essentially sponsored by the Catholic Church and was run by some Catholic priests and some Jewish organizers. And they were trying to make inroads into a Black part of the South Side, Roseland neighborhood, and were looking for an African-American organizer, and that's how Barack Obama got hired. He was a bit apprehensive about coming out to Chicago and immersing himself completely in the Black world. He expressed that apprehension to Genevieve Cook, the New York girlfriend. But it was incredibly important to him, and it was there that he really found his home.
Let's talk about his relationship with Reverend Love, and they still have, it would appear to me, a fairly close relationship.
Yeah, everybody knows about Reverend Wright, Jeremiah Wright, and his explosive rhetoric and how that got candidate Obama in trouble in 2008. And Obama and Barack and Michelle had gone to Wright's church for quite a few years. But his first entree into the world of African-American churches and preachers on the South Side was through Reverend Alvin Love of the Lilydale Baptist Church. And he really is the one who introduced Barack into that world and became active in the community organization that Barack was working in, and helped him. Chicago and that world of Black preachers was like a graduate school for Obama. He learned oratory and sociology and politics, and Reverend Love was extremely important in that.
And Reverend Love came to the inauguration?
He did, yeah. He came to the inauguration was helped Obama through his political rise. Really, he'd become the head of a Black Baptist organization in Illinois and really helped spread the network. And so he was part of the group of Chicagoans who came to the inauguration and told me a story of President Obama coming up to him shortly after the inauguration and saying the reality of what he was now as president washed over him, and he said, "Please pray for me. I mean it, man. I need your help."
So if he were to say, the president, "My hometown is," it really would be Chicago or not?
Yeah, he sings that song, Hometown Chicago, and I think it is. You know, I mean, born in Honolulu, most of his childhood there, plus Indonesia. But his life is really an arc toward home, and I think he found it in Chicago in so many ways, professionally and personally, that he never really had a sense of home until then.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Zachary in Sparta. Hi, Zachary.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
All right, so my question is, well, first off, growing up, I've grown up in circumstances very similar to President Obama's, uh-huh. And I remember when I was in seventh grade, he came to La Crosse, Wisconsin for a rally, and I was standing down near the reporters. I was very young at the time, and it's a tough experience, but out of the corner of his eye, he just put his hand down there and shook my hand. So I think it's really inspirational to see somebody come, you know, such a long way into politics and be so successful. But my question is, what do you think it was that really propelled him into presidency? Because I know he was a senator, but I'm just wondering what kind of aspects and, I don't know, what kind of mechanics were at work that really propelled him into a serious campaign? Because he almost seemed to come out of nowhere.
He did. I mean, when you think about it, in the year 2000, you know, he went out to the Democratic convention in Los Angeles that nominated Al Gore, and nobody knew him. And his credit card bounced, and he left after a day. I mean, that's 8 years later, he's president of the United States.
I know.
Wow. It's kind of an extraordinary rise. There's a lot of luck involved in it, and also an enormous amount of competitive will and sense of timing. The drive that led him into politics was sort of a study of power and what it took to try to change the world. And he, as a community organizer, he was sometimes frustrated by losing all the time. So he realized that he'd have more power in elected politics. He avoided the trap in Chicago of going on the city council with all of its racial tensions and so on. And that could have been a trap for him. He went instead to the state senate in Springfield, where he was able to develop a more diverse following, and that helped propel him. And then it was a matter of luck that he even was able to be in the majority in the state senate. Illinois was redistricted in 2000, and the House was Democrat, and the Senate was Republican, and so they had to have to break the tie. The Secretary of State for the redistricting put his hands into an Abe Lincoln stovepipe hat and pulled out a name, and it happened to be a Democrat, and so that broke the tie, and the Democrats redistricted the state in a way that the Democrats took control of the state Senate, and Obama all of a sudden was a committee chairman and doing some things that helped propel him further. And then he was chosen to give the keynote speech at the 2004 convention by John Kerry's people, largely because they'd met him a couple of times and were impressed by him and the story. And that speech propelled him, as did an earlier speech that he'd given against the war in Iraq in 2002. And so a combination of that anti-war speech in 2002, which helped him with the liberal wing of the Democratic Party in his eventual primary campaign against Hillary Clinton, the 2004 speech, which had that universality appeal of not red states or blue states, but the United States. All of that combined to just sort of create this combustion that people started seeing in Obama some symbolic things that perhaps weren't even the real Obama, but nonetheless inspired them more. And and it all just came together. And he got elected, you know, in, from anonymity 8 years earlier to president of the United States.
Sounds to me like you're well underway with book number two, David.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
I've
you are.
Quite a bit of reporting on it, but it's years away. I'm not going to do a quickie on it.
No. Thanks, Zachary, for the call. Scott in Appleton, hi.
Good morning. I was just wondering, if you haven't heard much about it, but the influence of Frank Marshall Davis on the president's worldview and thought. I was wondering if you might be able to...
Yeah, I always get asked that question. It's one of about five questions that come from certain people who are curious about Obama's past. And Frank Marshall Davis was came out of Chicago. He was a leftist who ended up in Honolulu as an old man and got to know Barack Obama's grandfather, Stanley Dunham, because they'd hang out at the same bars. And there weren't that many African Americans in Honolulu, and Barack Obama met him and probably was around him 10 times in his life. And from that, some people have developed this theory that this communist mentor is what trained Barack Obama. He definitely knew him and enjoyed talking to him. I don't see any influence beyond that.
His grandfather... And let's talk about race in Hawaii for a moment, because it's an interesting story. His grandfather would introduce him when he was very young as being of royal descent. He was the descendant of a Hawaiian king. Is that the story?
Yeah, well, you know, in Hawaii, everybody is, not everybody, but, you know, in some ways it was one of the best places in the world that Obama could grow up, because there are so many people of diverse backgrounds. They're called, in Native Hawaiian, it's hapa, half and half. And so there are people who are Portuguese, Chinese, Japanese, Native Hawaiian, Polynesian, you know, Haole was the name for Anglos. And the grandfather sometimes would introduce his grandson as a descendant of one of the Hawaiian kings, you know, just to enjoy the way people would respond to that. But Barack Obama was a hapa, you know, half African-American and half Anglo, half Haole. And as were so many of his classmates. One of his classmates was a kid named Tom Topolinski. It sounds Polish. He was Chinese, you know. So it was that kind of place. And interestingly, when Barry Obama was 6, 7, and 8 living in Indonesia, Indonesia, too, is a very, very diverse archipelago with hundreds of different nationalities, tribes. And many of the people in Jakarta thought that he was from the island of Ambon in far eastern Indonesia, because he looked like the people from there.
Hmm. I've never really had a deep understanding, and I probably say this as a mom more than anything else, but it's really hard for me to understand how his mom could have sent him back to live with his grandparents. So
yeah.
Tell me that story. I don't get it.
Well, they lived together in Indonesia for 3.5 years. And at that point, Ann Dunham's marriage to Lolo Satorra was starting to disintegrate. But she was very much attached. You know, she was only 17 when she got pregnant and 18 when her son was born. And in many ways, they were growing up together. She was a very intelligent, sardonic woman who had a love for the world, didn't want to be confined to anything. And she had developed this real affinity with Indonesia and the women artisans there, and wanted to continue there. And she didn't think that her son could get the education he needed in Indonesia. So she said, you know, she sent him back to Punahou, to Honolulu, to live with her parents, because he got into this great prep school, Punahou. And she said she'd be back soon. She did come back for about 2 years. She went to graduate school at the University of Hawaii, and she and Barry and his little sister Maya lived together in an apartment in Honolulu. And then after that, she wanted to go back to Indonesia to pursue her anthropology and work, and he didn't want to go. You know, that's sort of her choice and his choice.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, as the mother, she could have decided that if he didn't want to go, she'd stay in Honolulu. She did not. So they really saw each other during the summers and occasionally other times from the time he was in seventh grade through senior year in high school. And he loved his mother. She wrote him a lot of letters and was very much a presence in his life. But he carried some measure of anger about the fact that she wasn't there for him during that period.
Yeah, I can understand that. Pete in La Crosse. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Kathleen. The author initially mentioned some of the family inspiration that Barack Obama had, but I wanted to go back to that in regards to his seemingly excellent abilities to steer a really large ship, looking far down the road without being disturbed by small details close at hand. Can you mention again the relative and maybe other people who seem to have taught him this ability to steer this really large ship without getting disturbed about small details?
You know, I don't think he learned that from any particular person. I think he taught it to himself. He'd never had a real male role model his entire life to the degree that you can see it in some other people. But he did. And I think this is a very important way to try to understand him, whether you you support him or not. His whole life has been a series of efforts to avoid traps, and I think that's another way of defining what you are about not getting hung up in the little details. He's constantly, being born on an island, it can be a trap, even if it's paradise. Being born biracial and having to learn how to negotiate the different worlds can be a trap. Being judged by society as black because of the color of his skin and having to deal with that and the possible disillusionment that can come from that can be a trap. Chicago politics can definitely be a trap. All along the way, he's looking one step or two steps ahead. That's the way he deals with life and with politics and his presidency. So there can be times where his supporters are frustrated, wondering, what's he doing? Why isn't he clarifying things and responding immediately and vociferously? And whether he's succeeding at it or not, what he's doing is trying to figure out where the trap is ahead and, you know, as you would say, steer the ship around it.
Anything else, Pete?
No, that's it.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for the call. David Marinus is our guest this hour. His book, his latest, is Barack Obama, The Story. If you'd like to join this conversation, go to our Facebook page if you would like, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Marinus, our guest, and the book is Barack Obama, The Story. Let's go back. I can see this happening when he went to Chicago. You talk early in the book, David, about people being shaped by action and reaction to what they accept and reject from their own inheritance. He's understood best with that in mind, not only by how his family and environment molded him, but how he reshaped himself in reaction to them. Let's spend a little more time on how he reshaped himself.
Well, really, it was in essence, he was born with skin color of being black, so he had to deal with race from the time he was born, and there are many examples of where that affected him. But he had no he had no African American culture ingrained in him because he lived with his mother and grandparents, all of whom were white, so he really had to teach himself all of that. And that's really in sort of how he recreated himself, is this arc toward finding comfort and home as an African-American man, marrying a black woman and raising a family that way. And so I look at all of that as his search for home and recreation of himself.
Hmm. And how, in his heart of hearts, how do you deal with this abusive, absent, alcoholic father, and you've got half of his genetic structure in your body? How do you deal with him? Here's the president, for heaven's sake, who's got this father. I don't know what you do with it.
Well, I mean, he never knew him. He met him once in his life when he was 10 years old, and Barack Sr. came back to Honolulu for 3 weeks and sort of daringly tried to persuade Ann Dunham, who was then still married to Lolo Satoru but separated, to go back to Kenya with him, and was always bragging that he had a baby bull in America that he was going to bring back to Kenya. But beyond that, there was no relationship whatsoever. So he didn't know all of the realities of his father's life. He assumed that he was a very successful government figure in Kenya, not understanding that alcoholism and other problems had created a very chaotic existence for his dad in Kenya. Barack Obama Sr. was brilliant, so much so that even when he would get fired from a job because of his personal troubles, they'd bring him back because he was such a good macroeconomist.
Hmm.
But the son knew very little of that. And so how he dealt with it, you're dealing with a vacuum and sort of trying to, I don't know what genetically from his father. He doesn't have the alcoholism trait. He was addicted to cigarettes. He says he's quit smoking. I have no reason not to think he hasn't, but it's not an easy thing. He doesn't show, besides his sort of self-confidence and deep voice, which he got from his dad, he doesn't show too many of the other traits of his father that are apparent to me.
Mm-hmm. Storm in Lac des Flambeaux, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I was just wondering if you could give a quick note on Obama's oration skills.
Yeah, he really wasn't much of a speaker until he gave one speech at Occidental when he was in college at an anti-apartheid rally, and that sort of he realized that people would listen to him. But even by the time he got to Chicago, he wasn't much of a speaker, and he really learned by every week for a few years. He went to a different church on the South Side, black church, and learned from the preachers there, and took so that. That rhetoric, the oratorical skills that one saw in his presidential campaigns, all came from learning. It wasn't inherent in him. He wasn't a naturally stirring speaker.
Thank you, Storm. Joe in Dodgeville. Hi.
Hi. I understand your guest has done extensive research on Brock. And I'm curious because you hear about so many of this missing information about his records for schools. We don't know, a lot about when he was in college, what he, his grades and all this stuff. And there's all this, it seems like a gap in there. And have you studied some of that out? And, sometimes when there's a mystery and it brings up questions, but that's a, how did he get into college if he was smoking pot and playing basketball? As I heard you say earlier,
I know what you're saying, and I can't explain to you. I mean, there is a bit of a mystery, but I can't explain to you why it became such a big deal to so many people. I think there are other reasons for that. I mean, prima facie, he's an intelligent person, even whether you like him or not. You can tell that. He got, in high school, all of his teachers that I interviewed said he was a good student. He didn't apply himself very hard, but he was a naturally smart kid who got good enough grades to get into college. That was not a problem. He got into Occidental on a scholarship and money from his grandmother. He got good enough grades at Occidental to transfer to Columbia. Again, there's no mystery about that. And I wish he would release his grades. I think there should be transparency for every presidential candidate in every respect, so these little mysteries can't be created into huge, larger conspiracies, which are completely, unwarranted. There's nothing in his, I don't know why he hasn't released his grades. He hasn't. He told me that at Columbia he had a 3.7 grade point average, but I haven't seen the grades themselves. But there's no larger mystery to it than that.
Thanks very much, Joe, for the call. Thank you, David, so much. I'm so glad the book is out. I've been reading about it. It's coming out for a long time now in your adventures in various parts of the world, and it's just, you must feel really good, know that you've contributed such a substantial piece of work that will be a historical reference. That's a good thing to do.
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's what I try to do. You know, throwing what I hope, you know, serious biography out into the sort of somewhat unhealthy political culture is not exactly easy, but I am glad I tried to do it.
Yeah, I am too. Thank you.
Okay, Kathleen. Thank you.
David Marinus, the book is Barack Obama, The Story, just been published by Simon & Schuster. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program, and thank you for your interest and for calling. Thanks. Great conversations ahead.